Okay, thanks. So we'd like to continue the tradition of giving blackboard talks here, and also the tradition in this workshop not to present any numerics. we'll talk about continuous matrix product states, and this is kind of something that we have been working or thinking about. It's a very natural generalization of all these matrix product state methods, and it's the goal is actually to see what happens. Is there kind of a continuum limit of all these tensor networks that you can draw like this? And of course, it's not very surprising that this is possible, because if you discretize a quantum field theory, you get something like a tensor network in the path integral formulation. So it should be possible also to go the other way. And it was a bit puzzling how to do it. But then last year, actually here in KITP, Ignacio and myself basically constructed the whole formalism, and we have been working on this during the last year. And I think there's pretty interesting results that come out of it. Because it gives a new angle on what you can do in quantum field theory and how you can apply the variational principle in quantum field theory. Because that was actually something that there's very, very few works that have been done in that respect. And this is mainly due to Feynman. So Feynman tried very hard to use the variational principle. Of course, he was much more ambitious. I will only talk about 1+1 dimensional theories. He wanted to apply the variational principle to QCD and tried very hard, but basically failed. Okay, and I will kind of try to explain why he said that. So he came to the conclusion that actually for relativistic field theories, it's impossible to use the variational principle due to this UV kind of disaster. And then he came to the conclusion, if you apply the variational principle, the more parameters you use, if it's an interacting theory, the more parameters you use, the worse the results become. Which is very counterintuitive, but this is actually the way it goes. So anyway, so the work I will talk about today is certainly mainly with Ignacio Sirac, and then there's a few other collaborators that joined, so Tobias Osborne and Juto Hageman. This is a PhD student. Okay, so what is the setting? Okay, so yesterday actually Steve White coined or somehow proposed that maybe this whole kind of tensor network or this kind of matrix product states and this language could provide a new basis for doing quantum mechanics, for reformulating quantum mechanics or quantum many-body systems in kind of a new language. And actually, if you work with these continuous matrix product states, everything becomes much smoother and nicer. It's just like if you work with matrix product states, you have difference equations, you have kind of completely positive maps, and everything is kind of discrete and different. So if you do it in the continuum, everything will become continuous. You will get, instead of kind of completely positive maps, you will have this kind of Lindblad evolution. Okay, you get a Liouvillean evolution. So you get nice differential equations that describe everything. Somehow the whole topic of the whole kind of vision of this field is that indeed we want to kind of rederive something like the Schrödinger equation, but not in the Hilbert space, but in some kind of a limited space where we know that all the relevant kind of quantum states live. So the picture that we have is something like this. So you have to imagine that this is a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space, so it's huge. Okay, so like in the case of a spin system, you have an extremely high dimensional object. And then somehow what happened, and this is kind of the magic of these matrix product states and generalizations. Sorry? These are 2 to the n axis. No, I'm just trying to picture a high dimensional object. Okay, and there is a manifold of states that we kind of identified. So it's a low-dimensional manifold of states that we identified where somehow very interesting physics is going on. So like demonstrated by somehow the calculations of Steve already since 20 years almost now, it seems that indeed somehow the physics of one-dimensional quantum spin systems is, for example, very well captured by just optimizing in that kind of state, in this manifold of matrix product states. So what you want to do is maybe how can I describe the physics not by limiting myself on that manifold. So what happens is that typically you want to write down the Schrödinger equation. Okay, I have delta over delta t psi is h times psi, which is linear. Okay, it's nice and linear. The only problem is that the Hilbert space is exponentially large. The question is, there some kind of a representation such that somehow I could describe just the physics that goes on that manifold? Okay? Instead of working in this huge Hilbert space, maybe I can derive somehow some differential equations that are very similar to this, but that describe my physics that goes on in this manifold. So what are the steps that you have to do for this? So again, what I will talk about here is pretty trivial and straightforward. So I want to apologize for that. I don't want to offend people by making such simple claims, but I think it's actually, I find it very interesting because it gives you a new way of looking at these problems. So what happens is that suppose you have something like a matrix product state, and this is the manifold of matrix product state. You have a state here, okay? And then you want to evolve this with the Hamiltonian. So what I'm trying to describe here is something that's time-dependent DMRG. Okay, so what you have is you have a matrix product state, you have some kind of your Hamiltonian. And unfortunately, this Hamiltonian kind of takes you a little bit out of that manifold, okay? Because you maybe create too much entanglement or whatever. Okay, of course, we know that if you would evolve in imaginary time, at the end you will end up in this manifold. Okay, so somehow we suppose now that we just suppose that somehow the physics is well described by this manifold, but you get a little bit out of it. So what you do is you get a little bit out of that manifold, but of course you want to remain within your manifold. So the only thing you have to do is basically to project this thing back on this manifold and go to that point. Okay, and you do this in infinitesimal steps.
It's a terminology thing, so. In mathematical manifold means something different from the common language. I assume you are using another mathematical language.
I don't know. So how would you call some? I don't know how to call it. Okay. So how should I call it?
Well, I think manifold is fine, but just what do you know? As a mathematician, word manifold means homogeneous. I think you might have singularities. So you just need a collection of things.
It's like whatever. You have to imagine it's something like it could indeed be some kind of a surface somewhere in a high dimensional. Okay. So anyway, so what you do is you want, so you write this down. Okay, so now you can formulate this as a variational as a variational principle. I say, okay, I have a state here. I evolve with my kind of Hamiltonian on that state, and then I want to find the nearest state in my manifold that is as close as you can to that kind of thing. If you do this and you write these equations down, what you get, and within somehow the set of matrix products, is what you get is nonlinear differential equations that describe your evolution of that manifold. So what will happen is that you get something like this. So this is exactly what you do when you do time-dependent DMRG. But the nice thing by formulating in this kind of differential, in this infinitesimal way, is that you don't have to break any symmetries. You don't have to, like in time-dependent DMRG, basically you have to do the trotters. You either have to do some trotter step or whatever, so you always have to break some symmetry. It's either transitional symmetry, either kind of rotational symmetry. If you formulate it in an infinitesimal way, you don't have to break any symmetries. Okay? So what you can do is really formulate your quantum mechanics on that manifold, and you get nice nonlinear differential equations. Okay, and this is basically the physics that you want to describe. So instead of working in a huge dimensional Hilbert space where you have nice linear set of equations, somehow the quantum mechanics on that manifold is a kind of a low dimensional object, but you get nonlinear differential equations. Okay, and this is the whole program. This is what people are doing in DMRG and time-dependent DMRG and everything that somehow these tensor networks methods have to do. This is the underlying principle. Okay, we replace kind of nice smooth linear differential equations by some nonlinear differential equations on a low dimensional manifold. So where has something like this been done already very successfully? And this is actually in the context of mean field theory for field theories. Okay, so let's. So what I want to show you briefly is basically how do we derive something like the Gross-Pytayevsky equation. Okay, it's exactly, so this Gross-Pytayevsky equation, the way you derive it is exactly like this, and this will be the stepping stone to basically formulate an or continuous matrix product state. So what is this kind of, what happens in Gross-Pytayevsky? You have kind of a continuum theory, and somehow this manifold that you have here, you say, okay, I want to parameterize it by some kind of a wave function. Okay, I write it down as a wave function phi of x times psi x dagger acting on the vacuum. Okay, so this is the kind of the wave functions that you considered in mean field theory for a continuum system. So this is a completely trick. So there's very few parameters. The only parameters you have is basically this phi of x. Okay, just a function, a very simple function. And you take this integral over phi of x. And psi x dagger is a field operator. This is a field operator that creates, let's say, a boson at site x. Okay, so this
vacuum is defined by
with respect to this field operator. Okay, so what you have is something like psi x psi y dagger is delta x minus y. And also that psi x acting on a vacuum is 0. Okay, so this is exactly one manifold. Okay, this is such a manifold that you can write down. So this is, of course, even this infinite dimensional, but we have kind of just a manifold with one function. Okay, so obviously this is a very rough approximation, but actually this approximation works pretty well in many applications, especially in atomic physics, let's say in three dimensions. Somehow this mean field approach works very well, and you can describe Bose-Einstein condensation and so forth in this language. Okay, so what happens now? Let's try to do this program that I was explaining here within this kind of within this set of states. Okay, so I would like to describe basically the physics of that state on that manifold. Okay, so so what I want to do is I want to have something like delta over delta t phi is h times psi. So obviously that doesn't work, okay? Because if I have a Hamiltonian with whatever, with interactions or whatever, it will take me out of that mean field kind of states, okay? It will create correlations. But what you will do is say, okay, so what directions can I walk on that manifold? Again, there are actually many directions on which I can walk on this manifold. Namely, all the directions delta over delta phi of x of this state phi. Okay, because so these vectors are exactly the tangent vectors on that manifold. Okay, they tell me if I change that parameter at site x, okay, this is just a normal function. If I change that parameter a little bit, in what direction do I walk on that manifold? That's basically what this thing tells you, that this derivative with respect to phi of x of your kind of wave function. So again, I don't care too much about mathematical rigor here, but somehow you can actually make these statements rigorous. So what you say is that if you do this program, somehow you say, okay, I want to find the linear combination of all these kind of vectors that I have here that approximate as well h times psi. Okay, so what you say, I want to find the function chi of x, and then you have the arc min over all possible chi of x, such that the norm of this minus h times phi is minimized. Okay, say I walk an h times psi, and I want to find somehow the state on that Hilbert spell, on that manifold, that is as close as this as I want. It basically tells you I want to walk in this kind of direction, because it means you want the empty one, these are infinitesimal things. So this is a nice kind of quadratic problem in this variable chi of x. You can easily solve that because it's a quadratic problem. You do it in the Euclidean norm. And then somehow you say, okay, then my d phi over dt is equal to this chi. Okay, so it's very simple. It's completely trivial, but you do this, and what do you get? You get exactly the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. So what you get is exactly some kind of a nonlinear differential equation that governs the physics or the kind of the evolution of this. So what you get is exactly something like IH delta phi over delta t is equal to minus the Laplacian plus some kind of a local, let's say you have a one part, you have some kind of external potential, and then you have something like, and this is the important term, phi squared, and maybe some chemical potential, times phi. So what you see is that if you do this, you get a simple nonlinear differential equation in this function. So you started from a many-particle wave function, which is very difficult to describe. Okay, there's just too many parameters. But by doing this simple trick, you say, okay, I work on a manifold. Let me try to describe the physics that is going on in that manifold. You end up with the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Okay, this is called, this is exactly kind of very much in the spirit of these DMRG. We have a manifold, we get nonlinear differential equations, but this is very easy to actually integrate, or you can just do this numerically now. Okay, so you can deal with these systems. So what is the goal? Well, what can we do now with this matrix product states is actually generalize this such that we get a non-commutative version of this kind of Gross-Pitayevsky, because this is a very simple, there's no correlations here, no? This state, entanglement entropy is zero everywhere, okay? Because this is nothing more than basically a product state. Okay, this is, in some sense, if you would write this out, this is like something like identity. So if you discretize this or kind of take infinitesimal, this is epsilon phi of x psi x dagger times identity plus epsilon phi of x plus epsilon times phi x plus epsilon dagger times, so this kind of exponential, you can just write it as a product of matrices, but somehow these are just numbers here, okay? These are just numbers, and this would be, somehow you see already, you get kind of a product of matrices, and this is nothing more than a matrix product state with bond dimension 1. So the question is now, how can you kind of go beyond that? How can you generalize this such a sense that it makes sense, okay? That you can really take into account correlations, and also something that looks or gives you something like matrix product states. Okay, and this is exactly what we did here last year. So what we have done is basically some kind of a wave function. Okay, so let me erase that. Okay, so it's some kind of a wave function. And now we kind of, because we get matrices, we'll have to specify in what order will we have to contract these matrices. Okay, so we have to define some path ordering exponential. But the path order exponential is, of course, if anybody that has ever integrated the Schrödinger equation, you know what the path ordered kind of differential equation exponential means. It's just the solution of an exponent of a. It's kind of the solution of a differential equation. So, but okay, this goes from. So let's assume we have a system that lives in a box. Between 0 and L, arbitrary kind of external potential and the energy or whatever, and then somehow what we have is something like this. Okay, and then actually we take somehow, let me take something even with periodic boundary conditions. I will explain this notation and this acting on the vacuum. Okay, so again, these field operators. So basically, this case is a special case of that where Q would be zero, and this R of X would be kind of a function, just a function. Okay, so now the new thing is that these Q and this R are D by D matrices. Okay, and these are exactly the ones that will kind of take into account or kind of do make sure that there's correlation, that there's entanglement in the system. And this D is exactly kind of the number of states that Steve keeps in his DMRG or the kind of M or D, whatever, that the matrix product state. This is exactly this kind of. So what does it mean? Okay, so so what you have here or matrices. And somehow, if you would write down this wave function, let's say, in some kind of a first quantized form or whatever, you say, okay, what is the amplitude to have a particle at site x1, at site x2, xn, and somehow psi. Okay, you say, okay, let me project this wave function and see what is the kind of amplitude to have a particle like this, and you write it out. So this is a wave function, and you just calculate this very easily. What you will see is that this is something like the trace. Some u between 0 and x1, then you would have some r. I will define this u. And then u x1 to x2, you have an r, and so further. Okay, so every time you have a particle, you would have kind of an r. And every time you don't have a particle, this is kind of a free evolution. Okay, so it's kind of, so the picture that you have that comes out of this is that this is kind of, this quantum state is kind of generated by some continuous process. Okay, so you have some kind of a free evolution governed by this Hamiltonian. Then suddenly a particle is created, a physical particle is created. Okay, this is this R, and then again you have free evolution of this kind of virtual system. Then again a physical particle is created, and you have an R, and so further. So the thing is, these are these kind of auxiliary kind of dimensions. Okay, this is, so we kind of introduced an auxiliary particle in a virtual Hilbert space that is not physical, but somehow that plays the role of these kind of bond dimensions in matrix product states. So please interrupt me if something is not clear or if you have any question. Okay, but.
What happened to the Q factors?
This is nothing more than the exponential, the path-ordered exponential between 0 and x of Q of x dx. Yeah, sorry, this is.
So you're always in one dimension here?
So for the moment, everything that I say is in one dimension. Okay, so actually it is possible to describe or to kind of generalize this to higher dimensions, just like these tensor networks are not kind of restricted to one-dimensional systems. There's no reason. But of course, so things are much simpler in one dimension.
The fact that you ordered with respect to x.
No, but you have to see. So at the end, the ordering with respect to x, if you look back at the matrix product state, okay, so what you have is kind of a product of matrices.
Yes.
Okay, so the only thing is, what this path ordering tells you is that you have to match this index with that index, and that index with that index. But if you go to a two-dimensional system, you can still define a path ordering. Okay, so it's kind of because we don't need a very strong kind of form of path ordering. So what will happen in two dimensions, that just tells you that I have to contract that one before I go there or there. But I can do it in any, and then you have to contract that one and before I do anything else, okay? So it just tells you, you can still go in many, many ways, okay? But it's just a consistency. It tells you what indices of this matrix, how do I have to match them with the kind of matrices at the left or the right side.
Yeah, Yeah, as long as you're not going to assume some locality or
Yeah, yes, okay, but somehow this path order, it's not, so I always get this question, why this path ordering, this means probably that you cannot do it in two dimensions, that's not true, okay, this it's a very weak kind of form of path ordering that that comes out of this. Okay, so just to give an idea, so what could the kinetic energy be, or how do you calculate the kind of expectation values with such wave functions? Okay, so just to give you an idea, somehow if you put some kind of a field operator psi of x and you act on your state psi, then what basically will happen is that this thing splits. You will have some kind of a v, you'll have the trace of some kind of a v between 0 and x, and then you will have some kind of an r, you have v x to L, and this will be acting on the vacuum. And this V0x is now exactly this kind of path order exponential between 0 and x of that kind of thing. Okay, so.
What's the first sign of x? Is it the same
as. It's a field operator. It's a field operator, so it's destroying kind of a particle. Okay, and how do you derive this kind of formula? So V0x is nothing more than exactly the path order exponential between 0 and x of q of x plus R of x tensor psi x dagger. Okay, so in some sense, if you write this down as an infinitesimal way, okay, this path ordering, so what does it give you, this thing? It gives you something like identity plus epsilon times q of x plus R of x tensor psi x dagger. This times the same if you shift over epsilon. So this thing is nothing more than a product of matrices. Okay, therefore, if you kind of act with psi of x, so I'm assuming as we here, I'm assuming that we have bosons, but you can do exactly the same with fermions, but you have to be a little bit careful. Then you have to, of course, take care of the anti-commutation relations. So this psi of x on psi, I will be able to commute it through basically everything until I reach somehow, so you will be able to commute it through all these kind of products until you reach this kind of region. Okay, but we know that psi of x acting on the vacuum is zero. Okay, so the only thing that we have to calculate is basically the commutator of psi of x with exactly this whole thing here, identity plus epsilon q x plus r x tensor psi x dagger. So we'll get something like an r x times psi x dagger. And this is, of course, a delta function. And this delta function will cancel this epsilon. And therefore, you will kind of bring this r down. Okay, so it's actually very simple. So the only we always make use somehow this psi of x acting on the vacuum is zero. Therefore, acting like this is like acting with the commutator. Therefore, you can do this.
What is the epsilon? So how do you get this epsilon?
So epsilon is the lattice, so it's like a dt, it is like an infinitesimal parameter, it's the lattice parameter that at the end you take to zero. Okay, so this is just one way of understanding it. Of course, there's many ways of actually, you don't have to do this via the discretization, but that's just the simplest way of understanding how do you manipulate, how do you deal with this kind of things. For example, something that also can easily be calculated is, for example, so you can calculate expectation values. You can say, okay, what is my expectation value of d psi over dx at d psi over dx psi? And actually, if you do this, what will come out of it? That will be some kind of a left. And then you will have something like a commutator of qr tensor. Qr, and so some kind of a right eigenvector, or actually if you have periodic boundary conditions, sorry, this will be the trace of some exponential of some matrix T that I have not defined yet, times the commutator of Qr. Tensor QR. And so how do you see that from how you get these commutators out of it? You can easily see it from this kind of formula. So if you take the derivative with respect to x, okay, so somehow with respect to x1, let's say. So there's one unitary here between 0 and x1 to the left of this R, and there's one to the right of that thing. And therefore, somehow one of this one will give a positive sign for this Q, because this is the exponential, this is the integrated exponential, and this one to the left side will give you a minus sign. If you take the kind of derivative, and this is how you kind of get these commutators. So but anyway, it's not really important of how these things work. The important thing is that you can easily calculate expectation values, not just of local operators, also of derivatives and all these kind of things. Actually, all these quantities are finite and nice, but still, in the case of fermions, if you would have fermions, this actually would not not be good enough. This actually, there would be a divergence of the kinetic energy. Okay, and how? And the reason of that is that, of course, we have to be a little bit more careful maybe with defining these quantities. So, yes.
And before you go on, can you explain or give an idea of why is it so easy to compute expectation values? Just an illustration. So, if you want to compute the norm, or
yes. Okay. So. So the easiest thing is to look at it in this way. Okay, this is really the matrix product state language. This is like the A0. So yeah, okay.
Well, you have this Q of X and R of X. These are matrices.
Yes.
Where the elements depend on X. So you have functions.
You have functions. Okay, but let's assume that they are constant. Okay, if you want to. No, but we can do it with time, but if you want to ask me how do we calculate this, it's easier to make the assumption that they are constant, okay, that they don't depend on X. Okay, and then this is a translation invariant kind of system by construction. Okay, then this state is translation invariant by construction. Then somehow you can identify actually a matrix, so you can understand this this continuous matrix product state as a limit of a matrix product state in which you kind of, in this case where we only have one type of particle, okay, the A0, this would be basically saying you have no particle, would something like the epsilon times Q, and the A1 in the matrix product state language would be epsilon times R, and the wave function, if you write it like this, would be equal to the trace of the sum for I1 to IN, the trace of AI1 to AIN, and then you have some kind of an operator at site I1, at site 1 dagger to the power I1, A2 dagger at the power I2, acting on the vacuum. Okay, this is obviously a matrix product state, and somehow you will have to scale. So the thing, these A, I, AJ daggers, they actually are delta IJ divided by epsilon. Okay, so what we are doing here is kind of the usual discretization. If you have a field theory, you kind of can define on a lattice some kind of other field operators. These are not field operators anymore, but somehow they obey, somehow they are delta IJ divided by epsilon. Okay, so that's because, of course, in the limit when epsilon goes to zero, this must become a delta function. Okay, so and therefore this has to, you must have this 1 over epsilon kind of contribution. Now, so if you see this somehow, it's so the how do you calculate somehow the norm of that state. Okay, we know how to do that. That's using the transfer matrix. Okay, the transfer matrix. So we just have to look at one of these. So this is, I think most of you are familiar with matrix product states. And this is kind of the transfer matrix that you can define in the matrix product state. But you have to be a little bit more careful in this case, because the expectation value of these field operators goes to like 1 over epsilon. Okay, so you have to actually multiply this by I, this A, A to the power I, A dagger to the power I, and this is, this is basically the vacuum. The vacuum.
What's the capital A super end? Well, what's the superscript on capital A? No, up one line.
A1.
Oh, that's 1.
Okay, so this is like having no particle, this is like having a particle.
Okay, sure.
And this is now I1 to IN. So this kind of, I actually make the assumption that this creation operator to the power zero is the identity. It doesn't do anything.
Okay.
Okay, so this is like saying, if this is a zero, I don't do anything here. If it's a one, then I create a particle at site I1.
Right, then what's A10?
So these I's all go from zero to one. Okay, so we have, on every site you can have a particle or no particle.
Okay, so that's,
And you do that and you continue and this is, what comes out. So anyway, so if you do that, so somehow you get this to some kind of the number of sites. Okay, what is the number of sites if you have a lattice of site of length L? So the lattice is actually has some kind of the number of sites if you discretize scales, of course, like inversely with the lattice parameter that you choose to discretize the whole thing. So you get some kind of this thing to the power L over epsilon, and it turns out that this is nothing more than the exponential. Okay, because this is identity plus epsilon times something, because this is exactly in the way we chose this A0 and A1. It's identity plus epsilon times something, and you get exactly exponential of T times L, with the matrix T, actually the trace of this thing, but T is equal to Q tensor identity plus identity tensor Q bar plus R.
Different from what people usually do with the Trotter product when you turn quantum mechanics into a path integral?
I don't see any direct connection actually with Trotter because this is like.
Well, it's like you take a path integral and you put it up into little slices and then you can do treat these each as Hilbert spaces. So if you should go from the path integral to quantum mechanics.
But if you would do that for a one dimensional system, you would end up with a two dimensional thing.
Right.
And this is still one dimensional, everything.
Right.
So there's nothing.
This turns a 1D quantum mechanical system into a 2D path integral.
No, this is kind of, this is in some sense a 1D classical path integral. This is like a transfer function of a classical thing. So the whole trick of these matrix products, this doesn't, both in the continuum and in the kind of discrete case, is that you start with the quantum system, let's say, in one dimension. You kind of parameterize it using a matrix product state. And the matrix the calculations are kind of the physics of these matrix product states is very similar to the physics of one-dimensional classical systems. Okay, because you have to define a transfer matrix. This is exactly this transfer matrix here. It's a kind of a transfer matrix of a, in this case, of a zero-dimensional system. Okay, it's like, because it's somehow, this is a transfer matrix corresponding to a 1D classical system. And that's actually the reason why all these, this is one of the main drawbacks, of course, of these methods, is that all the correlation functions at the end in these systems have to decay exponentially. There's also something that Steve has seen very early, that if you do DMRG, you cannot basically, it's impossible to get a power law decay of correlations. So all the correlations that you can calculate will always decay exponentially. But of course, because somehow these dimensions of these matrices can be so huge, you can still capture basically all the physics. So I don't think anybody has better simulations for kind of 1D critical systems than Steve with his DMRG method. So somehow this kind of can take it into care, but if you have finite sizes, then you don't need this kind of infinite dimensional. But if you really want to have power law decay of correlations, this is what was actually mentioned by Ignacio, then these matrices themselves have to become infinite dimensional. And then you can really do it. Then these become operators. Yes?
Frank, isn't that the superscript and A can be the 0 or 1? So did you go back to...
Yes. So the A can be, this is the normal kind of matrix product state language. So you have this A's and all these matrices A can be, whatever, they are labeled by the physical Hilbert space index. Okay, so this is like I1 here. Okay, this is like I2. And this I1 can be 0 or 1.
But is it because you're doing fermions? Did you switch to bosons, you can create as many of them.
Yeah, actually, yeah, okay, but... So actually, but these are actually bosons. I have not been very careful. So if you have a lattice and you have a fine... So at the end, the systems that we will describe will always be systems with a finite density. So the number of particles in our lattice will be finite. So the probability of having two bosons on top of each other is basically zero. Okay, but that's if you make it rigorous, then somehow you have to define A2, and this A2 is actually epsilon squared divided by 2 times R squared. And the same for A n, actually. Okay, this is A to the n, this is basically n factorial, and this is thing to the n. Okay, this is the thing, but in the...
you have finite density, so once again, I ask what is the vacuum now? That really is the vacuum?
It's really the vacuum with zero particles.
Fermions?
Yes.
So it's not the film fermi or anything?
No. This is really the zero particle.
So once you have interactions, are these dressed operators operators?
They are really, so we define them as, so the vacuum is really zero particles, and then these are bare operators, okay? These psi's that we define are really the bare operators.
Interacting quantum field theory, starting with the bare vacuum, is a very bad thing to do.
That's also what we thought, but we still tried it, and actually we reproduce, we can see the Fermi C emerging and all this kind of physics. So it seems that these kind of states capture this. It was a priori not clear at all that this would be possible, but it turns out that these kind of theories are rich, or these wave functions are rich enough to actually to start from the bare vacuum, you can actually create somehow your physical vacuum. Okay, so at the end, in the quantum field theory, you want to parameterize your, this will be the physical vacuum, okay, not, and this is the bare vacuum, and you want to know what do I have to do, or somehow what is the physics or the dynamics that goes on to create the physical vacuum. Okay, and this is, of course, the parameterization of the ground state. So I agree, in quantum field theories, at the end, this is not the most interesting thing, actually.
The bare vacuum. In a
Yeah, but I can give you. So what we have done is, for example, we looked at somehow something like the Gros-Neveu model. Yeah. Okay, and it is 1+1 dimension. Okay, and I will explain this later. We can introduce something like a cutoff. Okay, there's kind of an intrinsic cutoff that can be defined. And this cutoff is actually nothing more than putting some limitation on the norm of these matrices Q and R. If these matrices are bounded, then automatically there is a cutoff in this kind of wave function. And if you have a cutoff, then suddenly somehow you can really represent this kind of theories with this cutoff. And of course, then you can vary everything as a function of the cutoff and see how things converge. And we basically reproduce all the kind of non-perturbative effects that people know in this Gros-Neveu mode. Okay, so it seems that somehow there is merit in doing this approach. Okay, so I'm actually going very slowly. One thing that is important that Ignacio also stressed in his talk is that these matrix product states have some kind of gauge conditions. Okay, these matrix product states are not are kind of invariant under some kind of gauge transformation. It happens that in this case you can easily define gauge transformation. You can go from Q of x to any other kind of matrix Q of x, but you define a G of x, which is kind of a group element or whatever you want, or just a gauge transformation times Q of x G minus 1 of x. So this would be a matrix of the same dimension as Q. And then somehow what happens is plus G of x D over DX G minus 1 of x, and R of x goes to G of x R of x G minus 1 of x. Okay, and somehow you can really kind of trace this back to the equations that Ignacio was writing down about gauge transformations and so further. So what is important is that you can always find gauge transformations such that this kind of set such that you get orthonormal sets of vectors. Okay, so just like in DMRG, it is possible to kind of make sure to use a basis in which you do your optimization such that your left eigenvectors and your kind of right vectors are orthonormal, which is very important to get these things work. You can actually do the same thing here. And what is interesting, or what is kind of interesting, is that what you see here, this formula, this reminds very much what you get when you do parallel transport. Okay, so there is really some kind of a gauge theory underlying this, and the formulas that come out of this are very much like what you expect from gauge theories. So anyway, this was just a brief sketch of how you do these kind of calculations. You kind of have to take this exponential. So in general, if you want to kind of do calculations or to understand somehow how does it work, how do I really kind of deal with these kind of things. So in the matrix product states, the most important thing actually to do is, if you have this matrix, I'm drawing a matrix product state, is basically you say, okay, if I start from the left and I kind of take the partial trace, I trace out kind of part of my system, I get an effective density matrix here. We get something like a row left, which would be as a function of x. Okay, this is your kind of effective density matrix from the left, and then you have also something that comes from the right. This is the row r of x. So by using kind of the right gauge transformation or gauge condition, you can always make this row left the identity. Again, the right would be some kind of an other density matrix. This is exactly this density matrix actually that we were talking about yesterday in the discussion, that kind of encodes all the kind of information, all the physics about what is going on outside of the region. Now it happens that to calculate these kind of things, so normally we have to evolve some kind of density matrix using a completely positive map. Okay, so this is what what Ignacio explained, so that somehow you have some kind of a matrix row and you have to go to some AI row AI dagger. This is in the discrete case. So not surprisingly, if you do this for this continuous matrix product state, you get into the continuum version of that. So what happens is that you get basically the Lindblad form. So what happens is that you have to come from rho, you get some kind of d over dt of rho, or d over dx of rho becomes some kind of I h rho plus r rho r dagger minus 1/2 times the anti-commutator of R dagger R rho. Again, this is actually called the master equation. Okay, so this is exactly, so for the people that were here last week actually, Peter Zoller had been writing down exactly these same equations. Okay, this describes basically the master equation of if you have some kind of an atom in some kind of a cavity. Okay, so what the dynamics, what that means is that you get exactly the same equations for this. So what happens is that, so the kind of systems that Peter Zoller talked about is that you have a cavity with some kind of a D-level, and I'm simplifying what he was saying, but just to kind of give you some physical intuition, what do these equations mean? So I have some kind of a cavity with a D-level atom, and this D is exactly the number of levels, or the number of states, or the number of states that you keep in the MRG. Okay, and there's some kind of, what happens is that there's some kind of a Hamiltonian evolution going on in that cavity that couples somehow the photons in that cavity with the kind of D-level system, and then these kind of photons go out of the cavity. Okay, and that's somehow what you get here is, so this is, so we want to describe the steady state of this kind of system. Now, if you do this, the evolution of this D-level atom is exactly described by this Lindblad equation. Okay, this is this master equation. Okay, so that means that actually these states, all these quantum states that we are talking about here, they all these continuous matrix products, they actually describe exactly the wave functions that come out of such cavities. Okay, so at the end, these are obviously many body systems. So you have some kind of a cavity with a D-level system. There's some kind of photons created, and they leak out of the cavity. And you would say, okay, I would like to write down the wave function of these photons that leak out of the cavity. This would exactly be the description actually of these wave functions. Okay, so this is kind of an interesting thing, because at the end, these are actually strongly correlated systems. So it means that with a kind of a single body with kind of a one, but kind of a zero-dimensional system, you can really create strongly correlated quantum many-body systems. Anyway, this is just to give you some kind of a context where these equations come or what come. So of course, what we want to do now is exactly the same as we did here for the Gross-Pitayevsky. Okay, so what we had is a Gross-Pitayevsky. We started from this kind of wave function, and we said, okay, we want to describe the physics on that manifold. Okay, so you write down basically your Euler-Lagrange equation and so further, and you get your nonlinear differential equations. You can do now exactly the same thing with these wave functions. Okay, so with these wave functions, actually, I have not shown you any evidence yet, but it happens that they also describe very well kind of the ground state or the low energy properties of your quantum field theories, certainly non-relativistic ones, but actually also relativistic ones. And you say, okay, let me just evolve that thing on that manifold. And what you get is nonlinear differential equations, not of kind of these kind of functions phi, but of matrix functions. So basically what you will have to do is to replace these phis with matrices, and you get this kind of coupled nonlinear differential equations that describe all the physics that go on that manifold. And this is again very much in the spirit of what Steve is doing. Arguing for that we want to have a new way of describing many body quantum physics, and this is exactly what you get. You get nonlinear differential equations of matrices. Again, these are really the quantum generalizations, or kind of the generalizations of the Gross-Pitayevsky equations, where you include entanglement, where you allow for correlations. Okay, I will not write them down because they are actually pretty. They're pretty extensive. But if anybody is interested, I can show them. At the end, they look very much like the way you do DMRG. In some sense, it's like the continuous version of DMRG would be the way you solve this nonlinear set of differential equations. Okay, but actually, there's very kind of good standard methods for solving such differential equations, and that's actually what can be done now. Okay, so what about quantum field theory? Because somehow, of course, this is nice and well, these wave functions, but why would they actually make any sense? Why would you be able why would they form a good representation of the ground states of kind of vacuum? Or how would you actually also describe excitations on top of it? Because if you have a quantum field theory, you're not just interested in the vacuum or in the ground state, you're also interested in kind of the effective theory above it. And actually it is possible to come up with ways of describing these kind of excitations, and this gives something that reminds very much of this kind of Bogoliubov-Degen theory. So now you can kind of basing your Bogoliubov-Degen theory on your kind of mean field approach, you can now kind of base it on this kind of interacting approach, on this matrix product state approach, and you get kind of all kinds of interesting equations. So what kind of theories have we looked at with these methods in quantum field theory? First of all, we have looked at something like the Liebig-Linegar model. So the Liebig-Linegar model is a very simple, it's kind of the Heisenberg kind of model for non-relativistic quantum field theory. So there's this something like this, dx, we have d psi over dx dagger with an index x, d psi over dx, plus some kind of a delta interaction. So what you have is kind of a point interaction. Okay, so what you have is a kinetic energy and some have a potential energy. When two bosons meet, then you get kind of a large, get a repulsive energy. Okay, so this is, so actually this the Gauss-Mitayevsky equation that I was writing down was exactly kind of the mean field kind of equation that you get when you consider this kind of Hamiltonian, the bare Hamiltonian. Now what we did is actually do the variation. We can calculate, either, as I showed, we can easily calculate these expectation values. Now we can write down this kind of nonlinear differential equations that evolve, that kind of tell you how to evolve this state. So we evolve these kind of states in imaginary time on that manifold. And of course, this converges actually very fast. And basically, we reproduce all the properties that are known for this method. Okay, so correlation functions, energy, the one particle, two particle. So of course, it's a bit difficult to make pictures of this. But somehow, all the features that are known are reproduced with relatively small bond dimensions. The matrix, the size of these matrices that we need are not when we take these matrices at size 10, we basically reproduce all the properties that are known. Okay, why is this known? Because this is actually an integrable model. Okay, you can actually solve this with the beta ansatz. This is why it's called Leib-Linegar, because Leib and Linegar were the ones who solved that model using the beta ansatz. But somehow we can reproduce everything, and we can actually reproduce more, because of course our method allows you also to calculate correlation functions. While this is very hard using a beta ansatz. Yes?
I think you were saying that using energy, everything
changes. Yes?
But in this case, if I would see equal to zero, it's a free boson.
Yes, but this is exactly the same kind of so if you look at if you take these matrices large enough, then you just see the power law decay until you go to the asymptotic limit, and then of course these matrix product states get exponential decay.
But can you extract exponential?
Yes. But just like in DMRG, basically DMRG also works for critical systems. It's the same kind of reason. So yeah.
Obviously, you compute the correlators not exactly by some variational method, right?
But once you have this wave function, you can calculate, of course, all correlation functions exactly within this variational wave function.
Yeah, of course. Well, I do the same thing with the beta ansatz too. You know, use the beta ansatz to sort of beta ansatz assisted numerics, because you can compute things simply. You can compute to much larger sizes exactly using the beta ansatz, and then.
I have a postdoc that is looking at this, because you can. So the interesting thing is that you can use all these tensor network methods or these matrix product state methods to within the framework of the algebraic beta ansatz. The algebraic beta ansatz turns out to be very, very similar. Okay, it's all kind of, you can reformulate the algebraic beta ansatz in terms of these matrix product states, and actually also the continuum algebraic beta ansatz is very similar to what we do here, and you can use exactly the same techniques. But the big advantage that we have is that, of course, we can go beyond the integrable. So there's nothing here that tells that these systems have to be integrable. Okay, that's actually, if you add some non-integrable term here, in practice, the variational methods work still equally well, and we can do a time-dependent, which is very tough, actually, for algebraic beta ansatz.
This is clearly much more powerful, but the question is sort of how can you tell how accurate the variational approximation is when you're doing this?
Oh, no, but we compare this with kind of, I think, there's also lots of Monte Carlo kind of results that people have been doing, and so we get really many digits of precision.
So this is a very nice, gentle, quantum field theory.
Exactly. So this is non-relativistic, and the important thing is, of course, that this is positive definite, and so that's why it's nice. But this is the first system we looked at. Actually, we did. So we were writing down all these equations that I was writing down here. We were writing down probably in the same room last year for the first time, and then we said, okay, let's try this for this. We programmed it for 1 hour, and we got out the results. So it's amazing how simple at the end all these kind of things are. So we just got out the results very, very quickly for such a model. But of course, the real challenging thing is relativistic theories. And this was actually the title of my talks. So somehow, models that you would like to describe are, for example, something like Dirac equations with some interacting term. Okay, this is actually called the Gross-Neveu model. I think Gross is actually the Gross from here that worked on this a long time ago. Okay, so they get some kind.
Yeah.
You get. Psi x, something like this, sigma y, d over dx, psi of x. So this is basically somehow the Dirac, the free part of the Dirac equation, I mean the kind of kinetic energy in the Dirac equation. You get the Hermitian conjugate, and then you get some kind of a term. So you get different kind of flavors. the normal ordered psi a dagger sigma z psi a squared. Okay, it doesn't really matter what this form is. This is kind of interaction. This is the free part, but you see this is kind of the kinetic energy, which is not positive definite. Okay, this is of course the whole point of relativistic quantum field theories, is that you have kind of UV divergences.
How many flavors do you consider?
We consider actually infinitely many.
So it's solvable enough.
Indeed, because we again wanted to play it with the exact results, and then we plotted basically this kind of chiral symmetry breaking parameter as a function of the different kind of thing, and we reproduce actually the right things. But of course, this is not.
It's been solved for any finite n, the mass gap is known analytics.
Yes, but the reason why we actually took the n equal to infinity, because I think this is all starting point, okay? This is all very, very new. And so the reason why we took the n equal to infinity case is that if you have these kind of chains, you have infinitely many chains. But if the interaction is like this, and you have infinitely many, somehow every flavor is interacting equally with any other flavor. And therefore, you can basically, so the thing is that you get a mean field within these one-dimensional theories. But that doesn't mean, of course, that it's simple, okay? It's somehow you get an effective interaction between these things, and therefore you can treat these kind of systems, these n coupled chains with n going to infinity, like one-dimensional system. But still, there's lots of non-trivial physics going on in that kind of system, and that's what we kind of looked at.
At n equals infinity, the model has much less fluctuations than at finite n.
No, but we also did it for, of course, we can.
To reproduce the mass gap, which is exponentially small, the coupling constants, because of asymptotic freedom.
I agree, we are working on that.
More impressed if you did this for n equals 2 than at n equals infinity.
No, actually, for n equals 2, it also works. But I don't know. The guy that's doing the calculation still, yeah, whatever. We are still. But let me sketch. So one thing that is for which you can present very clear data is when, for example, G is equal to zero, which is not trivial. These are then free fermions. Okay, we know that free fermions, if you want to describe them using matrix product states, are actually very hard. Okay, and what you can do?
Can you produce the mass gap?
Yes, we get kind of symmetry breaking, and we get.
Quantitatively, how many digits?
I don't know. I think we got 3 digits or something like that. But there's a paper out. We can talk about this later. But let me first explain what somehow the issues are, or what kind of what we want to do before we kind of talk about digits. Actually, what I wanted to mention is that. What I wanted to mention is actually the comments of Feynman. Feynman was actually looking at these relativistic theories, and kind of came to the somehow his kind of, he experimented with this, and what he saw was very kind of intriguing. So he says, okay, I have kind of a field theory. This has a kind of UV. So at the end, if this is zero, you have some kind of a Dirac. Somehow the energies as a function of k, whatever, they go to minus infinity, and then you want to put some kind of a cutoff somewhere. And then see what happens. So if you have an interacting theory, then what happens, of course, that these low energy modes are coupled to the high energy modes by some kind of non-trivial mechanism, because that's exactly what an interacting theory tells you, is that you get non-trivial kind of interactions. And what he saw is that if you suppose you have some variational ansatz that reproduces pretty well kind of the large scale physics, okay? Because at the end, if you have a quantum field theory, you're only interested in large, not in the UV physics, you're interested in the long range physics. And the more parameters, as you said, okay, have a reasonable wave function, and I put some extra parameter. And what that parameter does is basically screw you completely up. It will kind of say, okay, I don't care about the low energy physics anymore, because with this low energy physics, I can make it a little bit worse, my low energy physics, but I can get much lower energies, because this low energy, by offering basically my good low energy physics, I can create very kind of low energy UV modes. And that's basically somehow this. He came to the conclusion basically that, of course, there's a basic kind of failure that in this variational kind of concept that somehow doesn't work. But then he actually came up with some very interesting kind of comments. So he write this paper and then say, okay, that's very difficult. It didn't come up. But in the end, then somebody asked him, because it's kind of a transcript of a talk that he gave. Somebody asked him, but do you really believe that this is not possible? And then let me read what he wrote, because this is, I think, very kind of fits extremely well in the context of what we have been trying to understand in this conference. So actually, it's very visionary what he writes. And actually, if you have to, when I read this, you have to take to kind of have in your mind that what he's talking about is exactly the density matrix. Okay, so you have your kind of region of physics, and you want to describe somehow what is the physics outside of that region when I trace this thing out. And what he will do is he basically tries to say, to argue that we have to think about some representation of what connects the outside with the inside. Okay, so let me read it. So he says it's really quite insane. We are trying to find the energy by taking the expectation value of an operator, which is located here, and we present ourselves with a functional which is dependent on everything all over the map. That's something wrong. Maybe there is some way to surround the object or the region where we want to calculate things by a surface and describe what things are coming in across the surface. It tells us everything that's going on outside. And talking about a new kind of ID, but that's the kind of stuff we shouldn't talk about at a talk. That's the kind of stuff you should actually do. And I think Steve White did exactly that. Okay, so his density matrix that he kind of had in his in the matrix product state. So if you look at the matrix product state kind of language. So basically, what you say, okay, I want to optimize over this region. So what he says, okay, let's trace out everything here. Okay, and then let's also trace out everything here. And this gives me this density matrix left, density matrix right. Actually, by using gauge transformation, you can make one equal to the identity. But this is precisely kind of the density matrix that Feynman is talking about. This kind of density matrix encodes all the information about all the regions outside of the region where you're interested in doing your kind of variation, and then you kind of move on. Okay, so in some sense, what we do here with this continuous matrix product state is exactly the same. Okay, we try to find a density matrix that surrounds our object and then do the optimization. Okay, so just to this is more kind of these are more philosophical notes, but I think it's important to kind of put these kind of density matrices in that context. So why does it work, or how does it work? So basically what happens is that these continuous matrix product states, if some kind of conditions are fulfilled, they have very few UV degrees of freedom. So if you would plot basically your kind of expectation value of n of k, okay, which is actually, this is psi k dagger psi k, which is nothing more than the exponential of e kx psi 0 psi x dagger. Okay, so you really calculate the one point correlation function, and you take the Fourier transform of that, you get kind of basically your reduced density matrix in momentum space. And due to somehow the properties of these matrices that actually I did not really talk about, but there's some kind of, so this Q and this R matrices that we have, they actually, in the case of fermions, we can interpret themselves as some kind of a fermionic operator. And we have to impose some conditions on them, but that doesn't make things harder. And so what happens is that this N of K for large K always decays like something like the norm of these matrices Q plus somehow R. And this is very hand-waving, but somehow this is in effect what happens, divided by K to the 4. Okay, so what happens is that we have a variational class of wave functions that have whose kind of with some kind of a soft cutoff. You know that for very large momenta, the occupation number always goes like 1 over k to the 4. So you just have to put some kind of condition on these matrices. It doesn't matter how you impose it. You have to kind of bound the norms of these matrices. And if you bound this, then automatically you know that there's a cutoff in your theory. And you can shift the cutoff by kind of changing the conditions on these norms. And you do this, and we did this. Okay, so we took, for example, three fermions. Let's take three fermions, which is actually hard for this method. Okay, and we say, okay, do the variational calculation, and I plot this n of k, because we know the exact solution. The exact solution is obviously that somehow, if you have a cutoff, this should be the n of k. That's a function of k. So you fill kind of your Fermi C with antiparticles until here, and then it's zero with the cutoff. But we can try, okay, with this method. So we know that this we cannot reproduce, okay, because for large k, we will always get this k to the 4. So actually, I didn't explain how this k to the 4 arises, but this is due to the continuity properties of the wave function. So these wave functions that we write down, they have some very nice continuity properties. And because of the continuity properties somehow, because this is like a Fourier transform of a nice continuous function, you know that this kind of lowest order kind of, you can use partial differentiation and so forth, and you can immediately see if this is smooth enough, then you get the k to the 4. Kind of behavior. Anyway, this is good enough to kill all the UV divergences that you can have. And we did this, and we plot this, and then you take, for example, this d equal to 2. Okay, d equal to 2 is the lowest kind of approximation that you can have with these matrices. You plot this, and actually it's not very good. So what you see is that something like this. Like this. This is like, say, for the antiparticles, and then for the particles, we get something like, something like this. Okay, no, it's actually going much slower. So this would be the antiparticles, the ones that you want to be filled, and this would be the occupation number of the particles, which have actually higher than zero energy. Okay, so they go to zero, but you see it's not very good. But this is the d equal to 2. And you go to d equal to 3, and suddenly you improve a lot. You go to d equal to 10, and basically you're right on top of this thing. So for d equal to 10 already, what this bond I mentioned, basically it's a little bit, so here you get a very small dip. Okay, because of the this has to be continuous. So you get some kind of a dip, it goes to half, and then the antiparticles, as you get this, and then you get perfect this, and then from here on, you get the 1 over k to the 4. Okay, that means that indeed you reproduce the physics of this kind of free fermions with very small bond dimension. Okay, time? Okay. So I have to stop. We also looked at interacting theories, and actually we reproduce all the kind of things that are known, or basically known, maybe whatever, with a few digits of precision. So somehow it feels like these kind of wave functions capture the physics, and there's an automatic kind of cutoff built in these kind of wave functions, and you can all kind of start really doing quantum field theory. I think I'll have to stop here. Okay, thanks. No, but this is not the precision, no? This is the occupation number of the number of modes.
Yeah, but you're saying that even for free fermions, you get this tail, which you don't have.
Yeah, but at the end, you're not interested in this physics. What you're only interested in is that this physics is kind of reproduced.
Do you reproduce energy much better than correlations?
Actually, I had a discussion about this with Steve, and I thought that energy, because this is a variational method, you would always get energies, like the precision of the energies would always kind of a square better than the precision of the correlation function. But Steve doesn't agree. He says that the correlation function actually, if you calculate them using such methods, are of the same accuracy as your energies.
It's the local observables.
The local observables, like magnetization or whatever. In this case, of course, it's not magnetization, but the local observables seem to be reproduced by the same precision. Not the non-local ones. Okay.
Now within DMRG, I don't make any claims about that.
But you told me that's something fundamental, that this is because somehow the local things are kind of captured well and they are orthogonal, that somehow this would, your argument that you gave me would equally apply in this kind of quantum field theories.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the philosophy of this, because if you want the asymptotics, then especially for relativistic theory, you have the bosonization method or sort of change of variables that allow you to get the asymptotic essentially exactly up to certain coefficients that you can determine very precisely from the numerics. So here, what do you want? You want directly to have from the numerics all the asymptotics? So, it sounds very difficult to do. As you said, you will get tails which...
But these tails are irrelevant for the asymptotic. Okay, these are the UV modes. So we get the low energy physics. We get it basically right. Okay, so the philosophy is to try to do.
Physics is right at the discontinuity between occupied and unoccupied state. These are the states you will be able to excite when you want to look at the low energy excitation of your system. So the low energy physics is right at the discontinuity.
Yeah. Anyway. So what is the philosophy? Of course, this is just a starting point. Okay, this is 1 + 1, but we kind of know how to formulate also these things in higher dimensions. Okay, so it's a wave function-based way of doing quantum field theory. Whether we'll be able to do anything that goes beyond the kind of methods that you say, okay, the judge is completely out. But I think it's kind of certainly I find it very intriguing that somehow it is actually possible to write down wave functions that capture the physics of the vacuum. Of course, we can also now go to excitations. Okay, we can define now effective theories on top of these kind of vacua, and we can do real-time evolution. And I don't think any of these methods that you talk about you can consider something like quantum. I don't know whether this is actually relevant or whether this makes sense in this quantum field, but I guess it does. Okay, this is possible with these methods. So it opens up kind of a new kind of technique, whether it will be valuable or not. Okay, we have to see.
Keeping the interest of doing that, I'm just trying to understand here what you were trying to concentrate on.
No, but there's very few methods for simulating these kind of interacting kind of field theories. Okay, and this would kind of provide some kind of a new avenue actually to also go to higher dimensions and so it doesn't have to be integrable and so forth and so further. So I think there's actually many open questions for these theories. So I don't think everything is solved by bosonization.
No, not everything is solved, but it's the asymptotic plus numerics.
So this would provide numerics to get asymptotics, but would also work for gap systems.
Yeah, yeah, but
okay, so oh, yeah, that's true.
That's exactly what I meant, because if you have Paolo decay, then it's usually much more accurate, as was done by Steve White and many other people, to extract the Luttinger coefficient from thermodynamics and then plug them in the analytic to get the asymptotics.
Yeah, but indeed, but for gap systems, there's nothing like that, no? And this would actually work even better for gap systems. But.
Okay, sorry for being so picky, but I would really like to understand what you claim you have achieved. I mean, the Gross-Neveu model, depending on the number of n, has fairly rich physics. It has an O2n symmetry because these are going to be as Majorana fermions. They have a mass gap. The value of the mass gap is known in units of lambda ms bar.
So how does it work? It's something like a formula.
Some bound states. And so all these are fairly highly non-trivial results in an asymptotically free field theory, which is a rather non-trivial thing. So, for example, are you claiming that you got the mass gap in units of lambda ms bar to 3 digits accurate?
Yes, yes. So this is this pi that you have to reproduce.
What the number is.
It's something like pi, and then instead of pi, we get 3.149 or something like that.
So this okay. Is at n equals infinity.
Yeah, this is for n equal to infinity. It should be pi, and we get that instead. Okay, which is, I don't know. I think it's.
So you're not going to speak about numerics.
No, but let's talk about it. I can show you the data.
Okay.
I can show you the data.
So that in the normal non-trivial state, there was this idea of the normalization of the wave function, and then I have to take my map, and square of the map must be equal to the map. And here in this limplets, how does it translate?
So in that sense, these things are all already automatically scale invariant, because the only thing that you have, if you kind of rescale, you take the product, it's like an exponential of, let's say, 2 times t, you kind of coarse or micro gain. If you kind of take it out, then you get just 2 times exponential of t, because this is times epsilon, of course. So it is all these matrix processes are kind of scale invariant in that sense, but it's a trivial scale invariant. It doesn't mean that you have power law decay.
So can I make something like non-trivial
fixed points? Well, if you go brain, the fixed points that you will find here will be the same thing, the same as the ones that I was mentioning, because I mean, when you take an interval of that, this will be a completely positive map, and now you want to import this completely positive map. It's the same equation. So this is the other direction, I think. This is the direction in which you go cross-grain, but you zoom in, and then you will get the limit of the continuous theory.
So, if I understood correctly, is it true that you will never be able to produce a shaft from the surface using your technique?
So we could actually produce a sharp Fermi surface, but then we would have to impose very non-trivial constraints on the matrices Q and R. Because this kind of 1 over k to the 4 has to do with the fact that your first derivative is continuous, but your third derivative is not continuous. Okay? But you can impose, if you impose that the third derivative is continuous, that's a kind of a non-linear condition on Q and R, and you can in principle do that, and then...
Did you try it and see whether you get good?
No, we didn't try because... Yeah, no, we didn't try.
So in this manner, I will never be able to see whether there is a... Do you see a Fermi surface in the tubes and there are similarities?
No, I think this is pretty awkward. So somehow, actually this is even steeper than that, but this is like... this is 1 over k to the 4, right? So, but for the rest, this is kind of a Fermi surface.
I guess that we have... Well, just the last question, I think that there was one here.
Yeah, deviated. So you said at higher momentum, it's 1 over k 4, but... I think you said something like this cutoff depends on choice of the matrices.
Indeed. So the location of where this kind of cutoff lies mm-hmm. is dependent on the norm of the matrices Q and R. So by changing the norm, by changing basically the conditions of where you put the norm, this is exactly how you will kind of move your kind of, where you choose your cutoff. So you can choose your cutoff by kind of posing a condition on the norm of Q and R.
Maybe not people have misunderstood. So this would be like negative case. Okay, so you're populating here negative case. This is the frequency that you want to fill, and of course you would like to go.
No, so this thing is very sharp. Okay, so probably.
Okay, so that's the other side.
No, of course, of course. This is so the exact solution is that this is filled. to infinity.
No energy, you have corrective.
No, of course. That's the point of the theory. But that's what I told you. But I don't know. I didn't understand your question.
If it was for large cases,
this is
a large case.
So at the end, but doing a cutoff is like this is the theory. But of course, the interesting physics is here. And of course you can shift. So of course for an interacting theory you don't get the Fermi surface, and you can indeed plot, like if you do it for this Grossman Vermal, what you see is that there's fluctuations here. Okay, but we reproduce these fluctuations like this.
For interacting theory is whether you get the Paolo singularity at the Fermi surface correctly, which is what will happen.
Yes, indeed. And by doing finite size scaling and all this kind of thing, we get all these things correctly. Yes. Okay, I'm sorry that I missed. Well, this is the negative. This is the positive here that I plotted, and this is the negative. Like, and you get d equal to 10, then somehow this is basically 0 for.
Because I think that we should finish here, so thank you very much.